From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Brendan Gleeson didn't get his first professional acting job until he was 34 years old. Since then, he's worked with the greatest directors in the world, from Scorsese to Spielberg. With a career that includes several Harry Potter films, Gleeson is now too famous to walk around unrecognized, and he misses that.
To work in that environment, to get to work with these extraordinary cinematographers and creative geniuses, it's like, of course you're going to pay the price of that. It's not a nice price, but it's worth it. Like, it has to be.
Academy Award-nominated actor Brendan Gleeson talks about his early days as a teacher and part-time actor in a Dublin theater company, and his mixed feelings about two of his sons becoming actors. One thing he didn't want to talk about, playing Donald Trump in Showtime's The Comey Rule, as you will hear. But first we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So Steven Spielberg and Tom Cruise had an encounter at the Academy Awards luncheon where many, many of the nominees show up and toast each other. It was a very positive and upbeat exchange, which we'll discuss in a minute. I want to note that this comes after an estrangement going back to 2005 when Tom Cruise was in War of the Worlds. Almost you surely recall, Tom Cruise was very enthusiastic about Scientology and Katie Holmes in that period. He was very public. He got into a skirmish with Matt Lauer, and there was just a lot of negative publicity. And Spielberg, I reported at the time through my sources, believed that in the end, the antics actually cost War of the Worlds some $30 million in box office. I don't know how he calculates that. Then, the thing that I think really snapped the bond was Steven Spielberg naively, I think, talked to Tom Cruise about a psychiatrist who had helped a member of his family. And as you know, Scientology is very opposed to psychiatry, like extremely. And after that conversation, Scientologists showed up at this psychiatrist's office leafleting. Now, I think Tom Cruise was saying he had nothing to do with it, but it wasn't that convincing to Spielberg. And they've never worked together again. But at this luncheon, Matt, I will let you describe the joyous and celebratory conversation.
Yeah, they were best friends forever, apparently, at this thing. As Spielberg said to Cruise, you basically saved our ass. You saved theatrical distribution. And he's obviously referring to the success of Top Gun Maverick this past summer and the fact that it was the first real movie to bring older audiences back to the theater. And, you know, this could just be Hollywood niceties at a party. It could be that Spielberg truly believes that this movie helped save the business. And if so, that's a pretty big statement. And it's interesting because it plays right into the Paramount marketing campaign for Top Gun Maverick for the Oscars, where they're now buying billboards and ads essentially saying, this is the movie that saved the business. And if you believe in the magic of movies, you will vote for this movie for Best Picture. And that goes against the Fablemans pitch for Oscar voters, which is somewhat different and focused more on Spielberg and his career. So I'm sure Spielberg's awards consultants are probably not thrilled that he said this because it got a lot of attention, but it seems like he feels that and it's pretty heartfelt.
Yeah, it seemed very, I mean, we saw photos and some people saw it. The look on Steven's face is very enthusiastic. He said, you saved Hollywood's ass and you might have saved theatrical distribution. Seriously, Maverick might have saved the entire theatrical industry. That's a big compliment. And if there's anything that Tom Cruise could do to endear himself to Steven Spielberg, it is saving theaters because Spielberg, as we know, feels strongly, like many directors, like many auteur directors, that theaters are essential to experiencing film properly. Meanwhile, speaking of Paramount, there's a new book, Unscripted, by James Stewart and Rachel Abrams. You have reviewed this new book about Sumner Redstone and the waning days of his life at the helm of what was then Viacom and CBS and is now called Paramount, merged together again into one company. I will just note that Sumner Redstone, during that bad period in Tom Cruise's career, where he was actually at low ebb for his huge career over the decades, fired Tom Cruise publicly. So that happened. But then, you know, as we well know, we were dealing with it in real time. Sumner Redstone went into a tremendous decline and his daughter, Sherry, came into the game and basically took control of these two companies. And she's the one who recombined them.
Yeah, this book is pretty extraordinary because it picks up in 2016 when these two girlfriends, Manuela Hertzer and Sidney Holland, essentially had lorded over Sumner's life. They were living at the mansion. They were isolating him from people in his life, including his family. And ultimately, they extracted about $150 million from Sumner Redstone through various gifts and things that he had done on their behalf. And it's a fascinating book because it gets into the legal machinations that Sherry used to essentially have the girlfriends kicked out of the house and separated. And there are some very soap operatic twists here where one of the girlfriends, Sidney Holland's boyfriend at the time, fiance, the affair was revealed to Sumner, and he basically went nuts and had her kicked out of the house, and everything went downhill from there for the girlfriends. And it really showed just how scandalous this guy's life was in the final few years. These girlfriends had been pretty well documented. I mean, you did a pretty important interview with Sumner in 2014 in which the girlfriends were there and were pretty obviously controlling his life.
Curled up on the sofa, both of them side by side.
Right, and monitoring exactly what he said. And it was downhill from there. They really, at one point, they were negotiating to be put on the trust. And if that had happened, they potentially stood in line to inherit the entire Redstone family empire. And Sherry was not going to stand for that.
Yeah, I mean, and clearly at a certain point, I mean, first of all, I can't believe that Sidney Holland had another boyfriend and was two-timing 90-year-old Sumner Redstone, but that's the way that rolled.
Fiance.
Out, her fiance. There came a point where it really wasn't clear whether Sumner Redstone had an oar in the water when Sherry was taking charge any more than it was clear with the two women that had been in the house. Some people had an interest to say he's fine, he's compos mentis, and a lot of people wondered.
Right. And a lot of the same people switched their opinions based on whether it benefited them financially. And we haven't even talked about the whole Les Moonves saga, where he was forced out of the company based on the Me Too scandal that involved him. Sherry went through a lot to get this company where it is today, and we'll see what she does with it in the future.
Yeah, now it's considered small and a little bit adrift and fighting to stay in the game. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, a founding partner of Puck News. For more than three decades, Brendan Gleeson has worked with some of the biggest names in filmmaking, with roles in such movies as Braveheart, Gangs of New York, and several Harry Potter films. In 2004, the Irish actor starred in director Martin McDonagh's debut short film, the darkly comedic Six Shooter, which won an Academy Award. A couple of years later, the pair reteamed for the black comedy In Bruges, this time with Colin Farrell in the mix. 14 years later, McDonagh brought Gleeson and Farrell together once again for The Banshees of Inisherin. Gleeson plays Colm and Farrell plays Parik, two men who are close friends until one day Colm starts to ignore Parik with no explanation.
If I've done something to you, just tell me what I've done to you. And if I've said something to you, maybe I said something when I was drunk and I've forgotten it, but I don't think I said something when I was drunk and I've forgotten it. But if I did, then tell me what it was, and I'll say sorry for that too, Colm. With all my heart, I'll say sorry. Just stop running away from me like some fool of a moody schoolchild.
But you didn't say anything to me. And you didn't do anything to me.
Well, that's what I was thinking, like.
I just don't like you no more.
After premiering at the Venice Film Festival, The Banshees of Inisherin went on to be nominated for 8 Golden Globes, 9 Academy Awards, and 9 BAFTAs. It's safe to say that Gleeson has had a very busy awards season. At this point, I'm starting to wonder, did you spend more time shooting the movie or talking about the movie by now? I don't know.
Talking. But the movie was released in, I think, October. I think, was that when Venice happened or before that? I can't remember.
September, I think, yeah.
September, I think, in Venice. And that was very exciting. But Venice is not so much a business thing. It's more about the actual film, the creative end of things. So it was kind of thrilling that the film had traveled and people were responding to it even through, I understand there would be difficulties with language, even in English. The fact that people were responding to the films, even before the subtitles came up, people were laughing at whatever particular thing. So that was the first indication that we had. But yeah, it's been September because it created such an impact in Venice.
15-minute standing ovation, I read.
It was wonderful, yeah. You could feel the response in the room. That was more important, really, than the ovation for me. The producers would have been more thrilled with the 15-minute ovation because that becomes the headline. But for me, it was the reaction within the cinema that made the difference. But we knew it was crossing cultural lines. And I think that was the first indication that this could be as good as we were hoping it would be.
Yes. And congratulations, of course, on your nomination.
Yeah, thanks.
That must be something nice at this point, right?
It's a thrill. I'm not in the springtime of my career, and a little affirmation is not a bad thing.
Not a bad thing. Now, since your role in this movie is a very nuanced and fascinating one, I read somewhere that in life you are neither menacing nor grumpy. I thought, well, that's a relief, because that would be a difficult interview. But being a politics junkie, I wanted to ask you about another role, which is playing Trump in the Comey Rule, Billy Ray's series. I read, and I'm not sure which role you were talking about, but you said if you're playing a part, you have to go into the character's corner. You have to fight for them. And the reviews for that performance from you were really quite interesting and good, I will say. I'm just wondering, is it possible to go into Donald Trump's corner and fight for him? How did you manage that?
Well, to be honest with you, I did the job on the condition that I would not do publicity for it. For the reason, I think it's pretty obvious, that for an Irish person to come in and get embroiled in a political debate was inappropriate for me to do. I wanted to work as I'm an actor, I'm not a politician. Basically, the performance had to be it. So I'm going to stick to that, if you don't mind. I don't think there's anything to be gained from me, you know, expanding on what the performance was. The performance was my best that I could do in that particular thing. So I'm going to have to keep that one under wraps, I'm afraid.
Well, I enjoyed it. And the Irish Times congratulated you on your principles for even taking the role. So I understand how loaded and third rail that could be. And they felt that you were courageous to do it.
I'll just say one thing. Because I do go into my corner in this particular character, which I can talk about, I do believe this film is worthy of a second viewing. And I'll ask you to consider the idea that Colm is borderline suicidal before the film begins. And
yes,
that there's a grumpiness and there's a menace that I think can be the outward signs of a deep desperation. I don't think he's an unkind person of nature. I think he's drowning.
I will say, I mean, I want to hasten to add that one of the beauties of the performance is that he clearly is deeply unhappy, and yet these moments where his kindness breaks through, almost like the sun coming out from behind the clouds, are affecting. And I didn't want to suggest that that was all there was to your performance.
I just find it's been very interesting for me, because to get the nomination was massive. I'm so chuffed about it. I wrote to people, like my manager and people like that, and said, look, this is not, when I watched the film for the first time myself, I didn't feel overly sympathetic towards my own character, because the damage that is caused by this rupture is such that that's your immediate concern at the beginning. But having inhabited him, I do feel, if you look at something like Everything Everywhere All at Once, and you look at a woman who needs to break free of somebody who's incredibly nice, there's a similar kind of thing going through it. And also, actually, oddly enough, in The Good Nurse, you have this nice person that's kind of has this other side and stuff. Like, it's interesting what's in the zeitgeist at the moment about the need for a little less cynicism and more niceness and things like that. So in a way you say, well, I don't care what's going on with you. You've done so much damage. And in a way, the Civil War is your fault. And in another way, when you look to it and you say, but what is a person to do who is in a relationship that, even though it's not sexual, it's actually impeding him as a human being, and he wants to just be creative in his life and feel he has contributed something. And this has been thwarted by the fact that somebody needs him so badly, he won't let him go. And I feel there's a lot of aspiration that on the first viewing of the movie, people could not be expected to see. But one of the things that delights me about being able to work with Martin in that way has been to put that in there for maybe future examination, when the pain of what we look at in the immediate, where the death of just pure pleasantness and connection with the world has been ruptured, that when you watch the film again a little bit, that there is enough in Colm's character to see the aspiration in him and to see the desperation that's there, and to push the dilemma of what do you do when you're in a relationship that is impeding you from being what you maybe should be. I could talk about this all day, I'm sorry, but it's just, it's one of those things where Orson Welles once was asked, did he ever employ his friends in a movie? And he said, I did. And did I ever regret it? Many times. Would I do it again? Yes. He didn't think he was a committed enough artist to want to destroy friendships around him. And he wanted to be a human being first. But he admitted that probably the people who weren't going to make that decision and made the decision to follow their art were probably the best artists and probably the most impactful. So it's a, and all, that's all in there. Just putting
it's it also a theme of the Fablemans. So you're right. The zeitgeist is full of
completely, absolutely, absolutely, exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right. Isn't it weird how there's a kind of connectivity? And I don't know if it's in retrospect you can see it, but it's so odd that this same question has been asked in the various movies across that are garnering this kind of attention.
Yes. Well, I want to talk a little bit about your career. You started as a teacher, right? And you didn't act until you were like 34 years old. Is that right?
Well, it's not entirely true. I didn't act professionally. And in fact, I got one professional job during a summer that was a little bit weird. And we had started doing, there were a couple of people who we met at college. And one of them, particularly Paul Mercer, was a playwright. And he was writing in Gaelic, actually, at the beginning when I met him. And then he formed a theatre company and we started putting on theatre in Dublin all through the 80s. And we could do it on school holidays and things when we, you know, and he wrote plays and we acted in it. And then he got us writing plays and directing plays and all that stuff. And there was a whole series we called The Passion Machine. And yes, we became quite a phenomenon in Dublin to the extent that by, you know, the late 80s, we were in the mainstream theatres. We were paying to 1,300 people for like 20-week runs and things like that. We became quite successful. So I was doing all that while I was teaching in the time, you know, as a teacher, you can generally fit in quite a lot around, especially in Ireland. We get good sort of breaks, holidays and stuff. Mm. So I was acting, but I wasn't doing it full time. But it was 89. I decided to throw my hat in the ring full time.
Coming up after the break, Brendan Gleeson talks about the price of fame. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Brendan Gleeson has had a busy and eclectic acting career, performing in historic epics such as Braveheart and Troy, and horror films like Danny Boyle's 28 Days Later. He even played a grumpy but lovable inmate in Paddington 2, and he just finished shooting the Todd Phillips Joker sequel. With The Banshees of Inisherin, Gleeson has earned his first Oscar nomination. The film is also in contention for Best Picture. In his Oscar-nominated turn, Gleeson plays Colm, a man who has just dumped his best friend out of the blue. At one point, he goes to confession at the local church, and as he settles in to reveal his sins, the priest asks an unusual question.
And why aren't you talking to Padraig Sullivan no more?
That wouldn't be a sin, no, would it, Father?
It wouldn't be a sin, no, but it's not very nice either, is it?
Who told you?
It's an island, Colm. Word gets around. Also, Padraig asked me to put in a word like.
Having already worked with some of the biggest directors in the business, Gleeson's fame reached a new and somewhat uncomfortable height when he was cast as Mad-Eye Moody in the Harry Potter film franchise. I read that the late Robbie Coltrane had said to you, you can forget about walking through an airport again. It's difficult to browse in a shop. It's a big price to pay. And I think this part was you saying it. It's a big price to pay and I don't like it.
Well, sub-editors, I think, as a species, have some questions to answer. It becomes clickbait. It felt as if my disregard for all the benefits of being able to work at what I love working at, resented because I can't browse in a shop. And I frankly resented the headline more than I resented not being able to browse.
Well, we always blame our editors when things like this happen. We reporters are, my editor did it.
Yeah, I know. The actual article was nuanced. It was fine. But it was lucky with Mad-Eye Moody because the magic eye is not on when I'm walking through the airport. And for quite a while, it wasn't quite as intense as I thought it would be. It's always like Harry Potter was so odd because it was really my kids were in the car when the phone call came through and they were jumping and they were, you know, they weren't young kids. Oh, you got to do it, Dad. You got to do it, you know. And, you know, I wasn't really a part of that world at that point. And I had a brilliant time with them. It was a very healthy, great sort of enterprise on so many different levels. But the fame thing is a high price to pay to get back to the kernel of what you're asking, really. And I miss being able to, like in Ireland, I'd be quite well known. I've been going too long now. It's kind of, you know, it's 30 years. And so, like, it is difficult to move around in it. It's not anything like that in different places. But increasingly, it's a little difficult to move around in a space where you can be in your own headspace without feeling the eyes boring into the back of you. Or is that your man from whatever it is? Or what's that fella's name? Or, you know, the kind of self-awareness that you're trying to get rid of when you're 13 and you can't walk past a shop window without checking yourself out. That bloody thing used to drive me crazy. I remember thinking consciously, I want to be free of this constant self-examination of, you know, whatever it was. And it's very difficult to shed that out and about. And I miss it. Like, I miss being able to mix with people and being able to sit down maybe and just have a gawk, as we say, at people just passing by, just people watching. You just get to hear such sort of random, mad, beautiful, amazing things. And upsetting things and all sorts. And it's not easy to walk around incognito. But, you know, I'm an actor. That's who I am. And I absolutely love it. And I know how lucky I am. And to work with some of the people I get to work with, like to be able to work at this level. I mean, I'm out in LA now. I just finished working on Joker 2. I've been working with Joaquin Phoenix and Todd Phillips. To work in that environment, to get to work with these extraordinary cinematographers and creative geniuses, it's like, of course you're going to pay the price of that. It's not a nice price, but it's worth it. Like, it has to be. It's just I'm very uncomfortable in it. I find that it's very difficult to be yourself under constant scrutiny.
I get it. Well, speaking of the many great people you've gotten to work with, let's talk about your work with Martin McDonagh. I think you first did a short with him, a short film that won an Oscar, if I'm remembering right.
Yeah, there's Martin for you. Do a short and win an Oscar. he's just extraordinary. Like, he just is, you know. I remember we talked about it, and there were two things. I remember, I don't know if you've seen it, but there was a reference, and not just a reference, it was a plot point about a cop death. And I said, Martin, I'm very uncomfortable with this. I said, I've, you know, four kids. I don't know if you have or not, but you don't mess around with cot deaths unless you're really sure about what you're doing.
Which we would call sudden infant death syndrome, I think.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah. Yeah, yes, yes. And it was just such an appalling thing. You know, I knew he pushed the envelope out all the time with his work, and I kind of loved it in a way. It was an edge as always, and he always pushes the envelope out. But I said, I'm uneasy about what's going on here now. I'm not sure I want to do it. And we went for dinner for about, you know, for had a long chat about it. And in the end, he said, all my work is about love, basically. Mm. And it opened the door to me. And the more I went back, because I had, you know, his plays were extraordinary and continue to be. I just loved them. And I realized that no matter how appalling, and they are appalling, the behavior of people, you don't hate the people as such. It's the most amazing thing.
That's quite a gift, yes.
Mm-hmm. It's wonderful, but it means it's progressively creative. It's not cynical and devoid of love, or it's actually love is at the center of everything he does. And that was just such a joy to be able to go to that. And then we did that in a week. It was great. And then he goes off and he wins an Oscar for it. It was amazing. I watched it again recently. It's still
it still holds like up. It. Yeah. How did you meet him? He's got a brother too that you've worked with as well. Do they fight over you?
No, they don't. They don't need me to fight over. I met him in another extraordinary thing because Donal is my son, who's an actor. I have two actor sons. And Donal, he was going to be on the other side of the camera. That's what he wanted. He was more interested in. And he was asked to audition for a Martin McDonagh script called The Lieutenant of Inishmore, a play. And he read the play, and I read the play, and I'd seen some of the plays. But anyway, Donal was enthralled by this, went for the part, got the part, and went on to be nominated for a bloody Tony and became a full-time actor as a result of Martin McDonagh. When they went to the West End in London, when it transferred from Ireland to the West End, I went over to the premiere and I met Martin at that. So my son is responsible for introducing me to Martin, which is kind of amazing. And it was after that then we did the short.
And then you've worked with both brothers, both McDonough
brothers. Yeah, I met John, I think, first. John was with Martin at the Golden Globes, I think, for In Bruges. I think that's when we met. And he had one script he was kind of interested in doing, which I had got prior to that, but I didn't really make the connection. And then he sent The Guard, and oh my God, I could not put it down. I couldn't believe it. So we did The Guard together, and then we did Calvary together a few years later, which is one of the films I'm most proud of, to be honest. It's an extraordinary kind of a... I just think his writing is extraordinary too. So there are two phenomenal talents, and different and the same in some aspects, but very different in others. I mean, I hit the lotto, basically.
Wow, you've hit the lotto a bunch of times with a lot of best-known directors in the world, most admired. So that must be satisfying. How did you feel? Two of your... What do you have with a bunch of sons? Like four sons? Is that right? Did you want any of them to go into acting?
I don't know. Like, I remember in Braveheart, they wanted to audition them. And I didn't really want it to happen. And Mary said, sure, what harm would it do? They'll be out with their dad and stuff like that. And they came out. And I remember Donal was up or something or whatever. And it didn't happen. And I remember... I knew there was huge disappointment and all that kind of stuff. I'm really uneasy about the whole thing with child acting. I was very careful about it. Mm-hmm. But we gave them the shot, and they got a disappointment, and kids have to learn disappointment the same way as to learn all of the good bits. So that happened. And then so there was no question of me wanting to hoosh them into anything. Donald had a really good eye. He wanted to do film, and I thought it was with a view to writing and directing and things like that. But when he saw Martin's thing, he knew that's what he wanted to do. And then Brian, from the time he was 3 years old, I always kind of felt if he ever wants to, he was one of those kids who used to disappear into his own head, like for such a long time. And so I felt, you know, at one stage then I did a film which didn't go down very well, but which was extraordinarily prescient with John Boorman called The Tiger's Tail. And he was in his final year of what would be high school, secondary school for us. And it's a big deal about that's when you decide if you're going to college and all that. But anyway, John asked, would he play my son in that? And I said, well, I'm going to have to ask him. I didn't know what to think either. I didn't know if it's such a good idea. And anyway, he wanted to do it and he did it. And I think the bug was just too strong for him. And there's no decision for the parent to make other than support that, really. Well, how can you stop somebody? I understood from my own life that, you know, it would have been interesting had I gone a bit earlier. Maybe I should have had a little more confidence or something. But you have to give it a whirl. If it's knocking on your door, you have to do something with it.
Absolutely. Sounds like you know, were a great dad, honestly. I feel obligated because we talked about the film, The Banshees of Inisherin, and it does have many levels of meaning and great heaviness in some ways, but it's also really funny, like funny to the point where, you know, you could watch it by yourself and laugh out loud, which is pretty funny.
Yeah.
I'm sure you want people to know that because, you know, it does. Yeah. We don't want to make it sound like, okay, this is torture. Be prepared for torture.
No, it's not a grim fest. Martin's humor, honestly, would make a cat laugh. It's the funniest thing you're going to see. That particular word, sort of a grim fest. I remember the first time I used that was in regard to my own working life. I did not want to come and just do trivialities from my living. So I would insist, in as much as anybody ever has a plan in this thing, that every year there had to be something of real and artistic intent in it. You know, serious, creative, artistic intent. Even if that was funny, but it had to be serious in its intent. And then if I got that down for a year, anything after that, if you don't enjoy, say, the blockbustery type element, escapist element of cinema, you're missing the point. So I did not want to live my life as a grim fest either. And once I get something that I feel has proper serious artistic intent, the rest of the year is free.
Brendan Gleeson stars in The Banshees of Inisherin. The film is now streaming on HBO Max. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you. Thanks, Kim.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Phil Richards, Matt Schwartz, and Ray Guarna, who mixed the show. To hear more episodes of The Business, as well as other great KCRW entertainment podcasts, head to kcrw.com/FYC. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.